Well, today I'm going to talk about a little bit about syndicalism, but mostly about socialism. And then Monday, I'm going to talk about anarchism. So in 1864, the First International was created, the First International Working Men's Association. It dissolved among great tension in 1876 and also under the influence of the Commune because of the repression of working class movements in most places in Europe and also in the United States. Adolphe Thiers, who had crushed the Commune, as you know, boasted in 1877, nobody talks of socialism anymore, and rightly so, we are rid of it. Nonetheless, it is in the late part of the 80s and above all the 1890s, the crucial decade that socialist parties become part of the political scene in Europe, above all in Western Europe, because obviously the Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, when they are later created, are quite illegal in Russia. And the growth of socialist parties, above all in France, in Germany, in Spain and Italy, are part of the development of mass politics, thus closely tied to the emergence of political associations, of which the socialist parties would be a very good example, and the increased role of newspapers, party newspapers, and also just in general, the penny press. In Paris in the 1890s, there are 20 daily newspapers, maybe even a couple more than that, which is phenomenal. I mean, now there's what? There's Libé, there's Figaro, and there's Le Monde. I mean, there are three. And then there's also, I guess, the remnants of François, but there's just a couple compared to what they used to be. And so, you know, socialists proclaim themselves internationalists, and one of the great questions, as you see in 1914, as the clouds of war gather, whether socialist workers in Germany will go fight against socialist workers in France, and socialist workers in Vienna will go to fight the Serbs and the Russians, etc., etc. Now, you can get, you know, most of this out of Chip Sarwine's book, but just to make a few you know, fairly important points about the emergence of socialism in France, since France is what we are talking about. And then I'll break away a little bit to talk about syndicalism, which could be almost better done on Monday, but that won't work because I got too much to say on Monday. And then come back to socialism and talk a little bit about Jean Jaurès here, who unified the Socialist Party in 1905. Basically, socialists in France and in other countries are divided between revolutionary socialists and reform socialists. And revolutionary socialists were influenced specifically by Karl Marx. Indeed, Karl Marx's son, a guy called Paul Lafargue, whom you can forget, he introduced Marx's writings in translation in France. And as you know, Marx believed in scientific socialism. It was scientifically clear to him that inevitably following the bourgeois revolution, the workers of the world would throw off their chains after having united and led by class-conscious leaders seize power. So in principle, revolutionary socialists did not believe in elections, and nor did they believe in reforms. The general attitude of revolutionary socialists was that if you encourage workers, your miners in Germinal or whatever, to push for reforms or to participate into politics, in politics, political life, you're just propping up the bourgeois republic. If you do that. On the other hand, they get themselves into a bit of a bind, because how do you, if you want to have a mass following among workers, how can you not work for reforms such as the 8-hour day, which was a classic kind of demand of organized labor? How can you not participate in marches on May Day, the first of which was in 1890 in France, in order to put forth demands for reforms? They also were sort of caught in a conundrum, because they're arguing that following Marx's ideology, that the situation of workers was decreasing, was getting worse in France,
But in fact, despite the long depression, conditions are getting better for most workers, even though the gap between the wealthy and the poor was, as always, was increasing. So they're kind of caught in a bind. Their tactics are to organize workers, make them aware of themselves as a class, and make them aware of politics, and engage their revolutionary activity for a future date when everything when the revolution that they expected to come would follow. And remember, I mean, we live in a time now where you don't expect revolution to come when people just racing down to the town hall or to the prefecture and overthrowing the government. But if you grew up in a country in France in which your grandparents could talk, if you lived in the 1870s, you could hear your grandparents talk about stories they'd heard about the French Revolution. You had, depending on how you count them, a couple revolutions during the Revolutionary period. You had a revolution in 1830, you had a revolution in 1848, you had an attempted revolution in 1851 in response to the coup d'etat, and above all, you had the Commune. And the Commune weighed so heavily as a way of encouraging a militancy because, for as I said before, for you know one brief time, people seemed masters of their own fate. And the Commune did initiate, for all of the quarreling over politics and over policies, did initiate a meaningful reform. So this was, while it was scary for conservative elites, it is energizing for both people who want to capture control of the state, that is revolutionary socialists and indeed reform socialists, as we'll see in a minute, but their means were different, and anarchists who wanted to destroy the state. So there's an amnesty for the communards in 1879, and so people who were forced into exile or forced into hiding come back. Now, besides this Paul Lafargue, that is the son-in-law of Lafargue, is L-A-F-A-R-G-U-E, Marxism was introduced into France by Jules Guesde. If you're on the Île Saint-Louis, which is now, you know, this is sort of, you know, super chic, you know, sort of tourist trap, and has lost most of its charm, there's a plaque right on the corner, the intersection of the two main streets of the Île Saint-Louis, that you could hardly see it. It's up on the second floor, and it says that Jules Guesde was born there. So he was a Parisian. He was born in 1845, when the Île Saint-Louis was very different. There weren't all these Bertillon ice cream ripoffs and things like that there. He was the son of a schoolmaster. He gave up his intellectual pursuits because of lack of money. He worked as a translator in the prefecture of the Seine in Paris, and he became a journalist. And like lots of young, smart people in his of his day, he read Victor Hugo. He read Victor Hugo on Paris, and he became interested in the plight of the poor. He became a Republican. He was sentenced to 5 years in jail after of the Commune. He went off to Italy to avoid serving time in the Slammer, and there he read Karl Marx. In 1877, he created a paper, L'Égalité, or Equality, which had a circulation of 5,000, and you can multiply by about 20 or 25 the numbers of readers per each copy, because people read newspapers in cafes, so the diffusion of newspapers was greater than circulation statistics would lead you to believe. He wanted to capture the trade union movement, which had revived after the Commune. Again, strikes had been legalized in 1864, and unions are legal as of 1881. He was a very successful, clever propagandist, which terrified the middle classes. He was called the Red Pope by his enemies, both outside the revolutionary socialist groups and inside. He was also called the Red Jesuit because of his authoritarian personality. He was tall, very thin. And he looked starved, like many militants at that time, because they didn't have any money. So they're living from hand to mouth the whole time. Somebody described him as always looking ill and extremely pale. A fiery eye shone from behind metal-framed glasses, and when he spoke even about ordinary things, his lips seemed to quiver with rage. He was a powerful, ironic speaker, but not, you know, not a spellbinder in the way Jaurès, whom I'll discuss in a while, was. And so that's his enemies called him the Red Pope or the Red Jesuit. He helps found the first mass political party in modern France, which started out after a different name, but it becomes known as the Parti Ouvrier Français, or the French Workers' Party, which begins with some hesitation from Guet himself to run candidates in the elections in 1881, and they get some votes. But the goals of creating this party were revolutionary. They are not reformist. They are not to capture the Chamber of Deputies through elections and to make possible reforms that are promulgated from the Palais Bourbon, or where the Chamber of Deputies met, but rather to bring about a revolution. And his preoccupation with creating this mass party did alienate workers because they want reforms. And again, we talk about socialist parties, and you know what the socialist parties wanted at this time are basically what any kind of conservative Democrat would want in the U.S. They're talking about things like better conditions in the mines. They're talking about the 8-hour day. They're talking about decent wages and insurance programs and that kind of thing. And one of the interesting things about the Parti Ouvrier, this calls the POF. The Parti, Workers' Party, French Workers' Party, which also suggests that the role of personality in all of this is they do very well in specific regions. But overall in France, they remain an extremely minority party even within the socialist movement, particularly because of their unwillingness to engage in electoralpolitics and to be committed to reform. They believe that elections and the propaganda of these big posters that are red posters and purple posters that are still in the archives, which are wonderful things to look at, that these are to be sources of propaganda to make workers think about their conditions, to realize that their class enemy can be defeated in revolution. And so the places that the Guettists do very well are in the north, where you've got large textile and mining industries. They do very well in a very different kind of region, some similar interests, but industries, but without the kind of Catholic fidelity that remains in parts of the north. They do well down here in the Bourbonnais, in the Nièvre, in the Allier, in departments like that. And there are places in the south, in the Hérault, that is the department of Béziers and Montpellier. But in other places, like, for example, Limoges, where the Socialist Party was and still is very, very strong and remarkable continuity, they don't do well at all. So Guet is always sort of on the outside looking in, even within the context of the socialist movement. But one of the incredible things about these guys, about Guet and Bruce, whom I'll talk about in a minute, and above all Jean Jaurès, is they are on the road all the time. And here's where the railroads come into play. The number of speeches that they give every year is in the hundreds. They're constantly going, showing up in a town. I once wrote an article called "De la gare à la conférence contradictoire," or from the station to railroad station to the great debate, where they'd be debating people of other policies. They do the Tour de France, giving these speeches. And it's really in the 1880s and the 1890s that you really do have this sort of apprenticeship of the Republic and the apprenticeship of mass politics and of socialist movements through these debates. And that's what a conférence contradictoire is in French, or just call it a debate, a lecture followed by a debate. And for example, when I was studying porcelain workers in Limoges a long time ago, you'd have these guys like Bruce and Jaurès and the others show up, and they would be taken on a tour of Limoges, and they'd start out at the Bourse du Travail, more about that later, or the Maison du Peuple, and then they'd go around and see the factories, and they'd see the historical monuments in this. The same thing happened to me. I mean, I was there for a long time sleeping in a railroad station because I didn't have any money. One night out of seven because I was so broke then. But I was invited back and all this thing to get an award I certainly didn't deserve, and it was the same thing. It was exactly the same thing. The tour was the same, even though I knew the place very well, and we started out having aperitif, drinks at the Maison du Peuple, that is the house of the people, at about 10:30 or 11 in the morning, and by the time you make all these stops, it was a very, very long day, and the thing went on until 1:30 in the morning, literally, to 1:30 or 2 in the morning. And this is what the way it is now in the circumstances, but the way then is much more interesting, because what people would do is they would go, and you have some guy like Ged show up, and he gives his talk. He's up at the podium and gives his talk, and there are hundreds of people there. And then the other people take him on. Then you've got a reform socialist debating with him and telling him that he's really flat wrong about this. You've got anarchists inevitably standing on the outside passing out leaflets, as in 1968. And then you had social Catholics, who were priests that believed that the only way you could win back workers is to believe in reform, and they'd be wearing their cassocks and things like that, and they'd be making their cases. And this was the apprenticeship of politics, for very ordinary people. And it was really what's great, actually. And I mentioned the same thing happened before the Commune, between 1868 and before the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, after the law on associations was people could assemble the law of June 18th, 1868. So anyway, people knew who Ged was, but most socialists did not believe in Ged. Most of the people who wanted, who supported Ged were industrial workers, though there were many artisans, of course, and even some small shopkeepers. And I said before, he does best in the north and with textile workers, not with miners. Now, he was all over the place, basically. Now, he found a political rival in the early 1880s. Who was Paul Brousse? I didn't write Paul on the board, but Brousse, who started out as an anarchist and who probably coined that chilling phrase that I'll talk about on Monday, propaganda by the deed. That spark, that assassination, that bomb that would set off the social revolution. More about that later. But he leaves anarchism and he becomes a reform socialist. Very similar to an important German socialist, Eduard Bernstein, whose name you don't have to remember, but was very important in reform socialism in Europe. He ends up in an asylum at the end of his life. He basically leaves politics and he becomes quite crazy. Not a very clinical term, but he ends up in an asylum and has a very sad end. He objected to Ged's authoritarianism in terms of building a political party. And he thought that the program of a socialist party should depend upon local circumstances and should not be merely imported from, say, Karl Marx, or should be imported from one of the many, many socialist congresses, wrangling debates between factions of European socialists and all of that. Now, this was kind of an important comment to make, and it really influences the evolution of socialism and communism. Not this particular choice, but when even after 1905, when the revolutionary socialists and the reform socialists unite under the leadership of Jean Jaurès in 1905, you still have these tensions that go right through World War I between the Ghettists, who believe in a hierarchically organized political party, top down, where the leaders make the decisions and the decisions are passed down, and the reform socialists, who didn't believe in the kind of authoritarian hierarchical organization of a political party. I mean, this tension is still there. Jules Ged, in World War I, ends up being Minister of Transportation, or Minister of Commerce, I can't remember which. So he joins the Sacred Union that comes during the First World War. But this tension between a way of organizing socialist parties is still there, and it will burst forward again in 1920, and the Geddes end up being the future communists, with again the same organization, top-down organization in the 1920s and 30s, so that with the Communist Party, when the order comes from Moscow to expel the intellectuals in 1922 and 1923, they were out of there. And there's this tension between the way that, you know, the Communist Party, again, democratic centralism, which is leaping way, way ahead, but the kind of organization could be anticipated in the way that, that Ged wanted to, and the other revolutionary socialists believe was the way to power. That tension could not be swept under the rug by this unification in 1905. So what did Bruce want? Well, he believed that that Ged's program wants everything at once through revolution, but the result of that strategy, Bruce and his colleagues argued, was that they got nothing, zero. And therefore, the ideal, he wrote, should be divided into overall practical stages. Our aim should be, as it were, to be immediatized so as to render them possible. So reform socialism was the politics of the possible, and they damned their revolutionary socialist rivals as the impossibilists, because nothing would ever come, the argument went, if you just followed them. And so they differ in several important ways, that is, the possibilists and those denigrated as the impossibilists. The Bruceists, the reformists, said that local conditions ought to be of paramount importance. They wanted a union of all exploited all exploited workers, but that local conditions had to be taken into consideration. That is, the goals of miners in Decazeville or in the north are different than the goals of porcelain workers in some cases, you know, or other workers in other sectors in the industrial economy. Secondly, they abandoned revolution as a means of achieving the end, although many of their faithful believed that one day there would be a revolution, but they are not espousing revolution because at the moment it seemed to be impossible. The state was so powerful, its army so large, and when repressing strikes, so absolutely ruthless, as in the case of the big wine strike in wine workers and wine owners strike, a property owners strike in 1907, or in Limoges in 1905, where they gunned down workers without the slightest thought. And third, they concentrated on winning local power. Because if you were going to do something for ordinary people, the way to do it is, you know, you elect socialist deputies to the Chamber of Deputies, and you elect municipal councils that you have a majority who are socialists. Now, the constraints on municipal councils because of the French state, which is still the case, we can go on and on and on about that, it was quite daunting. But nonetheless, in places where they do win municipal power, they are able to take what funds they have and do things like create nurseries for working women. And they can give funds to the labor exchanges, which I'll talk about in a minute, or these, you know, Maisons du Peuple, and these sorts of things. And so in working class, because it's universal manhood suffrage, in working class towns, they come to power. And there's nothing that the conservative government, which certainly doesn't want them in power, can do about it. And after the radicals, you can read about that, in 1898, they're social conservatives, they're social moderates, but they're very anti-clerical, but when they come to power, they will also often have alliances on the local level with these socialists. Now, what this does is it serves to leave the revolutionary socialists even further behind. Because their fidel, their faithful, are going to say, of course I'm going to vote for this socialist candidate. If we win the municipal council, if the working class suburbs of X town are able to elect for the whole town a working class majority, a socialist majority, then we can have concrete reforms. And the Geddes really don't have an answer for that, and they find themselves despite themselves, participating in these elections, and supporting some of these candidates. Just two examples of towns, or three or four, but the towns that they sort of model cities that they take over. Limoges is one, where the socialist mayor is a reformist, and they do all sorts of interesting things. Roubaix is another one here, big textile town, again part of the conurbation of Lille, Tourcoing, Roubaix, right on the Belgian border. Montluçon is another one down in the Cher. I mean, there are all sorts of them. The examples don't matter. But this, again, is the politics of the possible. It's the politics of the practical. And so municipal socialism is one of those things that that emerges from these reform socialist parties. It comes to this sort of key moment in 1890. Is it 98 or 99? I think it's 99, where the first socialist minister is sitting at in a cabinet meeting, and it's a guy called not Mitterrand but Millerand, the name you can read in Sarrawine's book, and of course the Geddes go wild, because here you have in a cabinet meeting you have a socialist minister who is sitting at the same table with one of the butchers of the commune, with a former general who's the minister of war. And so they said, well, there you go. If you believe in reformist politics, what you end up doing is you're talking about propping up your bourgeois republic. You're sitting next to one of the butchers of the Paris Commune. There's your revolution. So this increases the tension. But in the end, the two parties unify, though they can't cover over these big differences in 1905. Well, Bruce, in any case, was a most unlikely candidate to run any kind of a revolution. He was a wealthy doctor, and his grandfather had been a wealthy grain merchant, and this presumably, for many of his constituents, an oppressor of the people. And his father was a professor of medicine who was related to a bishop in the Catholic Church. He somehow ended up marrying the daughter of a Russian prefect of police. And France is a relatively small, country in size. It's about the size of Montana. It's slightly bigger than Montana and much smaller than Texas. He knew Ged when he had been, that is Bruce, a medical student at the University of Montpellier, which is the second oldest medical school after Bologna in Europe. Again, he was when he was an anarchist, he was convicted of a press offense, and so he flees to Spain, organizing a small socialist club. Now, he accepts class struggle. I mean, again, here is this sort of middle class guy who is a leader of a party in which most of the members, both activists and simply people who are vote for them, are workers. And this too brings out another kind of tension. And inevitably, I mean, without making this too confusing, there's another party that is created by this guy, Jean Allemagne. And we can just deal with this very briefly, as Sarrawine does. He simply says, look, how can you have you got your revolutionary socialists saying, how can you have a party that's reformist, that's propping up the bourgeois republic? And then Jean Allemagne, he says, well, look at the socialist party. Look at the leaders of the socialist party. Are they workers from the mines of Carmaux or from the mines of Anzin or anywhere else? Are they textile workers or metallurgical workers outside of Saint-Étienne? No, they're bourgeois. They're comfortable doctors like Bruce or Jean Jaurès, who I'll come back to in a minute, who was a profond philo, was a philosophy professor. And what we need is a working class party in which workers will be both the leaders and the followers. So they kind of split off. And there are other groups that split off too. But basically, those are the kind of outlines of all of this. Now, by the way, Jean Allemagne was a typographer, and he claimed that Bruce was an opportunist, and so he was more in tune with the workers. But looking ahead, you can see the same thing again: the expulsion of the intellectuals from the Communist Party in the early 1920s, and this kind of suspicion of fancy speakers and wealthy liberal radical do-gooders from the middle classes at a time when people took class differences extremely extremely seriously. And if you looked at the Communist Party in the 1920s, the Communist Party's leaders are miners or metallurgical workers. And this was a very strong tradition to kind of even reject these intellectuals. Many of them became, you know, very famous, some of them very famous poets and painters and things like that. Is, you know, you're bourgeois, we don't want you. You have your only class interests in mind, not the interests of people who work. And so this is a tension that comes out again in terms of the future history of the Communist Party. And you can see the sort of transition from these debates before World War I to what will come next, inspired by the Russian Revolution, of the second one of October of 1971. So who are these syndicalists, and what do they want? Just to complicate things even more. Syndicalists, rather like Jean Allemagne, said, look, we don't want your basic bourgeois leaders, but more than this, even though one of the main syndicalists was pretty bourgeois, even more than this, we also don't believe in politics. The question of how to get from here, that is the relatively miserable condition of workers vis-a-vis other people, to there, that is a revolution, like the revolutionary socialists, they say, this does not pass through political engagement. That is merely a false a revolution, and you'll end up propping up the bourgeois republic, as with Millerand, as the minister in the cabinet of 1899. So what do they want to do? Well, what they want to do is they see the shop floor, and again, if you want to think about this as the mines, they see this as both the way to get to revolution, and they see it as the future as well. And so the radical syndicalists are very involved in the strike wave from 1895 to 1907. And so syndicalism, sometimes in Spain and in Italy, it's called anarcho-syndicalism. I'll talk maybe a little bit about that on Monday, or I know I won't have time, so let's do this here. Because of, again, the decentralized the decentralized aspect of that from the shop floor you build the bricks that are going to overthrow on a local level capitalism and the state, and the kind of relationships that people have in shop floors on the shop floor are going to make possible the revolution, and they are simply going to shatter a capitalism. Now, one of the institutions that they see as fundamental and which still exist in France are called the Bourse du Travail, or the labor exchanges. And Bourse du Travail was a place where workers who came into town could go in order to find out if there was any work there, to maybe get a few cents to have something to eat. They would sponsor dances. They would sponsor May Day celebrations. They sponsored civil baptisms, sort of mocking the church ceremonies by having civil baptisms in these labor exchanges. And so they become part of the socialist vision of how to get from here to there. I mean, the syndicalist vision of how to get from here to there, in that they are local institutions that bring together unions, which become members of these labor exchanges and serve as offer militancy, support during strikes, and sort of family solidarity as well. They are the idea, basically, of a guy called Fernand Pelloutier there, and they bore his mark. Pelloutier was himself bourgeois. Ironically, he was born in 1868. He died in 1901, so he didn't live very long. He was the son of a civil servant from a clerical and legitimist, that is, monarchist family, educated in a church school. He was kicked out of his church school for writing an anti-clerical novel. He failed his baccalaureate, his bac, that is the big exam that you take after lycée, after high school. That used to be only 35% of the people passed, then 50%, and now it's up to 85 or something like that. But it's still huge tension, huge, huge, huge tension when you take the bac. Amazing. But he failed the bac. But he'd already contracted that working class disease that killed miners and porcelain workers and all sorts of other people. He had contracted TB, tuberculosis. He was a journalist, but he had to drop out of journalism after 18 months for medical purposes. He emerged from all of this a changed man. He knew he was dying. And so when he wrote about the dying society of capitalism, he was also obviously writing about his dying, his death in this capitalist society. And I don't know where he contracted the disease. He did not you could contract it in various ways, but he did not contract it in the mines. So he believed that only the working class could regenerate the world. That is, not himself as a bourgeois, but only workers. So here again, he's very much like Jean Allemand there. And that ultimately what you'd have is a free association of producers that would rather be like an extension of the shop floor and the bourse travail. The difference between him and the anarchists was that he still believed in class struggle, where for the anarchists it was more in which the working class was privileged, but for the anarchists it was mostly the poor against the rich and also against the state. The bourse travail created libraries, for example, where workers could come in and read. And so one of the differences that it made, if you had a socialist municipality, is that the socialist municipality would give money to the bourse du travail. Whereas in reactionary towns or towns that dominated by radicals or opportunists in the political sense, then they wouldn't give money to the bourse travail. And so those are the syndicalists. And as far as Georges Sorel, who was an engineer, his really contribution was to come up with the idea of the general strike. The general strike. And the general strike, he calls it a myth. A myth not in the sense that it doesn't exist, but a myth in the sense that it is sort of overwhelming given of the possible. That can motivate people to take militant working class action, and that one day everybody would simply put down their tools, take off their work outfit, and shut capitalism down by simply saying we're not going to work anymore, and the whole thing collapse. Is it was it naive? Well, obviously it was naive. But this was Sorel's, among others, big contribution to syndicalism. And again, when these strikes move from factory to factory in towns like Limoges, in towns like Roubaix, and in other places, in Saint-Étienne, there was a sense among conservatives, as among working people, is this the general strike? Will everybody shut the place down? And workers during strikes, they would go from factory to factory, trying to get other people to go out. And who knows, the factories up the road will go out. And pretty soon Lyon, rumors of Lyon going out, and then it shuts down in Nantes, and pretty soon you can bring capitalism down with the general strike. It doesn't really work out that way, obviously. And the what's called the heroic age of syndicalism, that is of strike movements, goes from 1895 to 1907, and then it sort of shuts down. Now, how did the Socialist Party become unified in 1905? And again, all of the tensions within the Socialist Party are not eliminated. But the French Socialist Party becomes a major, major force in French politics. And that was largely through the work of Jean Jaurès, who I want to take a few minutes to discuss now. Now, in Germany, the SPD, or the German Social Democratic Party, is the largest party in the Reichstag by 1914. But it doesn't make any difference, because in 1914, Germany is still an autocracy run by this sort of madcap, ridiculous, extraordinarily stupid, don't get me going, but extraordinarily stupid Kaiser. And But in France, it did make a difference because France was a parliamentary regime. Well, you can't call France a democracy because women didn't have the right to vote, but it's a parliamentary regime. And Jean Jaurès, by his personal charisma and intellectual energy, becomes the unifying force of the French Socialist Party. And again, in 1981, when François Mitterrand was elected president of France, the first thing he does is the cameras follow him around the Pantheon. He goes and to pay homage to Jean Jaurès. So what his importance is, he creates a unified socialist party out of these various factions, and he gives it an impetus and a popularity and a wide range that would carry it basically after his death on the 31st of July, 1914. Carry it into the 1920s and 1930s beyond. Despite later claims, he was a bourgeois by birth. His family had included merchants and lawyers, two admirals, and a bishop. His father was the poorest of the family, although he had married the daughter of a successful cloth manufacturer. He ends up having failed at business with a rather small farm of 15 acres in the south of France. And Jaurès was born in 1859 in Castres. Castres is northwest of Toulouse. It's quite close to Carmaux, that mine and glass producing town there. And the Tarn is beautiful. It's also got some very nice Gaillac wines, and they've made great improvement over the years. But it's essentially outside of the glassworks and the mines. It's a very rural a department. Of 50,000 people on the farms, there were 34,000 were small property owners, 12,000 tenants and sharecroppers, and 16,000 day laborers. So it's your basic rural France in the process of being slowly depopulated. He got his education because of a wealthy uncle who gave him the money, and he won all the first prizes in school. And things like that count in France. He obtained a scholarship to Paris. This is rather, again, like Maximilien Robespierre, but they were very, very different people and wouldn't have liked each other at all. And he gets into the École Normale Supérieure, which is one of the grandes écoles, or the big fancy schools in Paris, and he did brilliantly. He was third behind Henri Bergson, famous guy, and a forgotten school teacher. He got his degree in philo, in philosophy. He becomes a teacher in Albi. That's what you do when you get your doctorate. Then you go on to be a school teacher, a lycée teacher, and then if, you know, now it's harder and harder in France because there's so few jobs, but then you go on to become a professor. So he becomes a lecturer and then a professor in philosophy at the University of Toulouse, which then and now is a very good place. He developed a reputation for being a great teacher. And in the philosophical sense, always was trying to reconcile idealism with realism. If you've seen photos of him, he gave a rather uncertain impression. Someone once dissed him as saying that he looks like a junior secondary schoolmaster who will never get his higher degree and will never exercise enough, or he looks like a fat merchant who eats too well and too often. He's of medium height and rather square looking. He's neither ugly nor beautiful, neither unusual nor common. He had a nervous tick of the right eyelid. He looked bright, and indeed he was. And when he started to laugh, when he told jokes, he would simply shake all the way from the top all the way down. He was first timid in religious matters, but ends up being anti-clerical, though not anti-religion in any sense. He was always embarrassed when the subject of religion was raised. He would get out of it by saying, "I assure you it is more complicated than you think." He looked like a bourgeois on holiday in Dieppe or some place like that. He looked untidy, inelegant. His pockets were always crammed with papers and indeed with books. He had rather big pockets. But he was a great orator. People who followed those things, you know, we don't have films of him speaking. That would come later. But really, Leon Trotsky, who was also just a great orator, I mean, they were considered the most magnificent, you know, speakers, really, of their time. And there were a lot of good ones, particularly in Germany, among all sorts of political types. he, unlike one of his friends, Viviani, who took lessons at the Comédie Française and practiced them, there used to be, one of my colleagues used to practice his lectures in one of the parking lots, and he'd look at himself in the mirror, you know, these rear view mirrors, and I don't know why I thought of that, but anyway, Jarez was not like that. He was just a brilliant speaker. He was born being able to speak. And he could take his crowd on dizzying verbal flights. And the thing he could do was he could unite people who would come into a room and have very different ideas. Thus, the unification of 1905. Just on a personal side, the person I know that most reminds me those politics are very different was my old late friend Bart Giamatti, who was president of this place long before you guys were here, and who died in 1989. It was the same sort of thing. You could come into a room with Bart Giamatti, and I often didn't agree with him about some things, but almost always did, and revered him, and still miss him terribly. But he could, at the end of talking to him, everybody would kind of agree, at least the momentum to find conciliation and to agree to this common goal that they all shared was a fantastic, fantastic experience. And when I think of Jarez, I think of Bart. But Jarez could do that, and that's what he did. That's what he did in 1905. And so he ends up in the Chamber of Deputies. He represents the Tarn. The mining bosses get together to defeat him once, but then he goes back, and he's there for always, and then until the 31st of July, 1914. And when he spoke, people listened. And when he spoke in 1905 and all the years before that, people listened, and the Socialist Party unified. And when he went on the road, whether he's in Besançon or whether he's in Quimper, people listened. And he was on the road constantly. And he became a voice of progress and reform and reason in a world increasingly gone mad. And you know, on the night of the 31st of July, when he went to write his famous headline about whether French workers should follow into the war or not, it was one of the crucial moments of the 20th century, and it was certainly his last moments. That's for sure. So he defended the workers in the strike. He became a political dynamo, really, of the left, respected even by his enemies because of his power and his ability to take the bigger project, that was France, of course, but was the happiness of humanity, and to see how we could best arrive at that. That end, a most admirable character. Anyway, 1905, for all the tensions, the Socialist Party itself, revealing the mass politics of the new era of the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century, right up to 1914, was essentially his work. And Monday, people who didn't want to change the state, didn't want to capture power in the state, but wanted to destroy it. And these include some of the more interesting people that I've known, at least working on them. Have a great weekend.